You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.
Hello, my name is David Bryan, and this is Curiosity Invited, a podcast inspired by endless curiosity. Tune in for an open-minded conversation about interesting and important things. David Bryan, Curiosity Invited. Several weeks ago, I had the occasion to speak with Larry Birnbaum. Larry Birnbaum is a computer scientist who works a lot, has been working a lot in the area of artificial intelligence, specifically language processing, natural language, language processing, computer generated language, etc. It was a fascinating conversation. It went on for close to 2 hours. And this is a shortened version of it that deals specifically with ChatGPT and artificial intelligence and pieces like that. If you want to see the full thing, the full conversation, it is on my YouTube channel, Curiosity Invited. So I hope you like it. Well, welcome, everybody. Welcome to Curiosity Invited. My name is David Bryan, and today I have the great pleasure of speaking with Larry Birnbaum. Probably in certain circles, that name is well known, but in others, it may not be. Larry is a computer scientist. Among other things, he's a professor at Northwestern, where he's been a professor there since the late 80s, I believe, 89, I think it was.
That's right, yeah.
Is according to something I read. And he was both, and is this still true, Larry? You are both in the computer science or engineering school and journalism?
I think technically that my courtesy appointment in journalism has lapsed, but I actually still teach over there, and I'll be teaching a course with a colleague of mine, Jeremy Gilbert, in the McGill School of Journalism at Northwestern this spring, a course with CS students and journalism students in technology
fabulous.
And journalism.
That's great. And so you've been doing this a while. And anyway, thank you. Thank you for being willing to speak to a lay person about something that, it's funny. So Larry got his PhD in computer science from Yale in 1986.
Probably that's right.
Something like that. Yeah.
It's a long time.
And
ancient history, anyway.
It's ancient history. And he may be more modest than I'm going to be, but about him, he has been in all sorts of ways at the cutting edge of a corner of computer science for many years, and that corner is on the tips of everybody's tongue these days. ChatGPT and the Microsoft's Tay and the artificial intelligence that is, increasingly is either seen as the great step forward or something that should keep you all up at night. And Larry's been generous enough to come and put up with people asking stupid questions and not understanding. And
I mean, just to say, David, a little bit about that. I mean, I've worked in natural language processing, which is getting computers to manipulate or understand or generate natural language, for most of my career. But I'm not an expert in machine learning or in large language models, neural language models. I obviously know something about them, and I do research with them and using them. But it hasn't been my area. So it's of specific expertise. And that's the sense in which I wanted to sort of.
And that is exactly what I thought, especially the more and more I read some of your stuff and looked at and watched lectures, et cetera, to listen to and watched lectures. It was like, what's he talking about? This is his area.
I understand. I mean, I think it's partly protection also. If somebody who really is an expert in this area watches me, I want to make sure they know I know. Did the proper disclaimer.
Yes,
I'm not pretending to know something I don't actually know.
So. Well, so how important at the beginning of this conversation is to define terms? So there's a lot of that thrown around, right? There's AI, there's machine language, there's artificial intelligence, there's deep learning, there's yada yada, there's NLP, yep, and LG, and whatever.
Yep.
So, is it, are there differences between some of those things, a little and a lot, or is it under one umbrella called, I mean, obviously it's all called computer science, but is AI deeply different from machine learning, different from deep learning, and how important is it to understand those things for right. us to understand anything you're going to say?
Right. So the first thing to say is that AI, artificial intelligence, is actually itself a pretty broad field.
Yes.
With a lot of different kinds of technologies and a lot of different kinds of problems. Absolutely. There's audio analysis, there's speech recognition, there's natural language processing, there's machine learning, there's deep learning, which is a kind of machine learning.
Right.
There's theorem proving and logic. There's planning. There's graph. Tremendous amount of stuff that goes on under the hood in any one of these systems. And there was a famous idea very early on in AI. Problem. It's no longer AI because it just becomes another computer program, you know, so right. it doesn't seem mysterious anymore. It's just another. So, of course, there was a time, for example, when route planning, the kind of thing that Google Maps does for you or Siri or any of those commercial systems, that was an AI problem. I mean, doing route planning and figuring out, given a graph, how to get from A to B would have been considered an AI problem. I mean, and it still actually takes a certain kind of AI technology, and we still teach that stuff, you know, to people in AI. It's just that it's kind of become ubiquitous and no longer considered. It's not a research area so much anymore, perhaps is another way of putting it. It's a mostly, although not completely, solved problem. Yeah.
Well, so does it make sense for you to talk a little bit about, this is genuinely a question, does it make sense for you to talk a little bit about the research that you did? I know you were one of the founders of a company called Narrative Science, which is, right. I think it was sold to Tableau and then to Salesforce. And
right.
And where is that now? Are you still involved with that?
Yeah, I am actually. I still work. I'm an advisor to Salesforce. I don't work for them full time. I work for Northwestern University.
But, sure.
Narrative Science was maybe the first, one of the first companies aimed at generating natural language narratives or stories from data. So the idea was basically this, you know, as more and more data are being gathered, of course, data science and data analytics have become more and more important as a basis of decision-making, of human decision-making. I mean, more of these decisions are being data-driven all the time because we have more data. Mm-hmm. And there's this kind of last mile problem, which is you have some data analyst who sets up some system and they have computed some numbers for you. And now you have to convey that information to a human being who's a decision maker, you know, who's going to actually, and that might be you as an individual who's deciding what to do with your finances or with your right. health, or it might be right. a company trying to figure out what to do in terms of market analysis or segmentation or something like that. And, or production problems or processes. And so this last mile problem is how to convey the results of the analytics to people in a way that they can understand so that they can actually take coherent action on it. And that turned out to be quite a challenge. So data visualization, you know, which you may know of, that's the generation, automatic generation of charts and graphs from data. And, you know, and they're all over the place now.
Right.
They don't have right. to be created by hand anymore. There's systems to do that. So, for example, Tableau is maybe the premier software platform for generating charts and graphs from data. Tableau was acquired by Salesforce a couple of years ago, which is how the Salesforce connection happens. Mm-hmm. We took a different point of view, which was rather than trying to present the people in terms of charts and graphs, maybe we would present the information to people in terms of natural language narratives. And we started with sports stories, actually, with baseball game recaps. So we would take the data from a baseball game, the line score, the box score, and the play-by-play data, and we would actually generate a sort of something that approximated the AP short recap, which is a story that's usually written within an hour after a baseball game ends. And it did a pretty credible job. We actually got a system that could do quite a nice job of that kind of thing. And that's when we started the company Narrative Science. That original technology was developed at Northwestern University and by me and my colleagues and some students. And we loved it. I mean, it was great, actually. And just to be clear about this, there's no point in doing this for professional sports because there's plenty of money in professional sports to hire a human being to write that story. Do you know what I'm saying? where it becomes important is in things like youth sports, like Little League. Yes. You know, you can't afford to assign a reporter to every Little League game or every high school football game or something like that. It's impossible, right? So it costs too much money to actually do that. So if you can get those data, and there are organizations, for example, there's a company called Game Changer, which has a smartphone scoring app. And if a coach or a parent uploads the data from a Little League baseball game, you know, we can write a story based on those data and actually give it. And who reads that story? You know, I don't know, 3 people, 5 people, you know, 10 people.
Certainly, I mean, everybody on the team.
Yeah, the kids on the team and their parents, sure, and their happy parents and grandparents and friends.
I mean, absolutely. You're in the paper. So
that's exactly right. So that's kind of the, so I guess the main point to say there is that it becomes important to do this by machine when you need to do it at scale. When you need to do it, in other words, if you need to write 10 stories, hire a person to write 10 stories, even 100 stories.
Right.
When you need to write 10,000 or 10 million stories, then you actually need a machine. And then the question is, when do you need to write that many stories? And the answer is when it's personalized, when it's a story for you about things that matter to you and nobody else. Right. And because then we have to write the story for you based on your concerns and the data that are relevant to you. And that's when automation and AI matter, really. Yeah.
And in one of your lectures, I just thought it was a great example of, you know, it was a particular store, and I don't remember if it was a deli or a food store or an auto parts store or something. And to have the specific, because it's in the data, but it's probably not in the data in a way that anybody who's working in the store is going to understand how to use it. But this, you know, to learn that, oh, that was it. There was a Reuben sandwich, right? To learn that the Reuben sandwiches in your store were not selling nearly as much as in that store, you know, at the next town over. Which, well, you know, that's tedious and stupid from you, but for people working in that store and certainly managing that store, that's crucial. And how do you get that information? Yeah. The idea that there's a program or that there's programs that can extract that information and give meaningful, useful information is really, I mean, phenomenal, really.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, that's that. Of course, let's be clear that prototype was not built for a restaurant franchise that sold Reuben sandwiches.
Yes.
That was to protect the innocent or the name of the organization that actually does do that. But yeah, so for example, fast food franchises, the manager of those stores have access to a tremendous amount of data, but they're very busy people. You know, I mean, they're incredibly competent people, but they don't necessarily have degrees in, they don't necessarily have MBAs or degrees in data analytics or something like that. And so taking those data and distilling them into a form that is meaningful to them and giving them something that's actionable, you know, and what I think what the line that probably stuck with you is what I, when I talk about that story, I say, this is the world's most boring story, unless you happen to be the manager of this restaurant, in which case it's an extremely interesting story.
This is the most interesting story you've gotten all year.
It's interesting to you because it matters to you, right? So, you know, it's funny when we were doing the baseball game stuff, the baseball game recaps have a pretty set structure, which is you typically have to talk at the beginning about who won the game and the basic reason why they won the game, what happened. And here we have kind of analytics that are about things like the shape of the game. And what I mean by that is, you know, was this a defensive struggle? Was it a blowout? Was it a come from behind victory? Was it due to one very strong player or was it a team effort and so on? And you can see the patterns of the stuff in the data and give voice to that in the story about who won and why they won based on these kinds of things. And then you have to talk about pitching because in a baseball game story, the pitching is very critical. So you then talk about the pitching. And then after that, you have to talk about the other significant things that happened in the game. For example, if somebody, you know, got on base a lot, you know, you have to mention that even if it wasn't really relevant to the outcome of the game. Mm-hmm. So because it's a significant event in baseball. And so there's a bunch of other stuff down there organized either temporally in terms of the inning that it happened in or by the player. You know, we had when we first did this, you know, we had a budding sports journalist on our team, and we asked him, you know, so what's the format? And it turned out there was a format. It's the one I just gave you, but it was actually hard to pull it out of him. This is a very common right. experience of people working in AI and other kinds of sort of disciplines involved with experts, which is people know a lot and they don't know what they know.
Yes.
And you have to actually kind of pull it out of them, you know, kind of forcefully to actually get them to enunciate it. Anyway, at one point I thought, hey, you know what? We could actually rewrite this to be have a kind of a cliffhanger thing. There's a kind of a hackneyed thing you could do. And you see this sometimes in television scripts, for example, where the opening scene will be some confrontation or something, and that turns out to be the middle of the story. And then it backs up to the beginning of the story. Like, yes. How did we get here?
Right.
And then eventually about the middle of the show, you finally get, and then you go on from there. And I thought we could do that. We could have a sort of a baseball game story that went, hey, you know, it's late in the game and,
exactly.
You know, they're down by two and it's two outs and Mighty Casey is at the bat and .. How did we get here?
Well, it occurs to me though, that it's, and maybe this is why people study what you study, but so there's a shape to a story, according to, you know, according to the journalism guy, according to the sports writer. But then that information somehow, the context, the shape of the story, the all of that has to somehow be in some sort of frame that the actual goings on in that game sort of have to fit into. That's
right.
Maybe that's what computer scientists do. I don't know the answer to that, but it seems like the ideas of how do you know something is similar to something else? How do you know this is the same context or a different context from that? It's just
huge
and
problem.
Then how do you express that in a way that is easy to sort, that is sortable by a machine?
So this is really a very, you touched on something that's pretty deep and kind of, I'll just say this. First of all, human beings do operate in context, and we're pretty good at recognizing the context in which we're operating and understanding what that means from the point of view of what we ought to be thinking about, what we ought to be attending to, what we ought to be, you know, how we ought to be behaving and so forth. That's a challenge for machines. Even I want to say something, that machines are becoming more and more contextually savvy, and we can touch on machine learning and how that's and sort of large language models maybe in this context.
Mm-hmm.
They've certainly gotten much better at that, but this remains kind of a difficult challenge for computers. Now, people are not perfect at it either. I mean, people
right.
sometimes misunderstand the context that they're in as well, obviously. So it's not like we're trying to emulate a perfect mechanism, but but the reality is that's quite difficult. And for as an example of this, I mean, for a machine to understand that it has no idea what's going on is actually not an easy thing. You know what I'm saying? In other words, to build a system that understands the limits of its capabilities and understands when it should stop trying to do something is pretty challenging. And so, for example, in the self-driving cars that are currently being tested out in San Francisco, they do occasionally, when they start to get confused, I think they have this kind of model where, okay, just stop. And so the cars will literally stop kind of in the middle of the street, and they won't move any further until somebody comes and resets them, because they do have some sense that they become incredibly confused. But the only response that they have to that is, you know, freeze, basically.
Yeah.
That's the only thing the engineers could think of to do in that context.
probably a good idea if it's a car, right? Yeah.
Well, yeah, you don't want it running into anybody,
no,
for sure.
Right.
You know, so
right.
It's been that's definitely a big problem. Now,
yeah.
This whole issue of context shows up in language a lot, because whenever you say something, it's in the context of the situation that you're operating in, and the previous things that people have said within that context, right? And that's actually a big problem for all AI systems, to really understand what part of that, how big that context needs to be. This, for example, is a limitation of the current language models. They have a relatively limited context of text that they can actually use in terms of looking back to what was said earlier, how far back can they look, you know, to be able to understand? Now, human beings don't necessarily, if you're reading a book and you were in chapter 12, you might not remember everything that happened in chapters 1 through 3, but you have some recollection of that, you know, and you can refer back to that in the story. That's pretty difficult right now for AI systems, because we don't have a good model of context, and because the simple models of context that we do have aren't big enough. So there's a kind of a bizarre limitation right now in neural language models, which is how big was the computer that you had to generate the model, and how much history can you afford to keep in generating that? And currently right now in GPT, I think that the
GPT,
which is OpenAI's. So there's basically a number of companies that are doing research in this. Google actually pioneered a lot of the technology in this as a company. I mean, to be clear, neural networks, the renaissance of neural networks originally, anyway, to make a long story short, I think OpenAI's GPT can look back 4,096 tokens, and you can think of a token as a word, roughly speaking. That's how far back it can look, and it can't look any further back than that. Mm-hmm. So if you say to me, gee, that seems like an awfully simple model of context, how many words can you remember?
Right.
I'd agree with you. It is a simple model of context. It's a good enough model of context to actually do some amazing things, but it's not. We're not done, is what I'm trying to say.
No, right. I get it.
A lot of work to do.
Yeah. Plus, well, okay. So you mentioned GPT. So let's go there. I think ChatGPT. Well, you know, it's either the end of humankind or why bother even learning anything? Everybody can do it. A machine can do it for you, and all that. And so we know neither of those is true, but. So as I understand it, and from my experience of what I tried, is you can ask this program, this thing, to, hey, write me something, write me three paragraphs on Larry Birnbaum playing baseball and, you know, for the Yankees in any year you pick. And it will generate some story based on a search of Larry Birnbaum, the Yankees, baseball, et cetera. Is this true?
Yeah, it can. Well, it can do that. And the question is, you know, what does the result mean, or how good is the result? And that's going to depend I want to say a couple things. First of all, it's an absolutely amazing tour de force in technology. I mean, you know, the history of AI, I mean, one thing to say about this, first of all, is this has taken a long time. I mean, AI started in almost at the dawn of the computing era. You know, Alan Turing, who's one of the founders of computer science, wrote arguably the first paper on AI and he developed the so-called Turing test, which is, could you fool a person through a conversation into thinking that a computer was a person, roughly speaking. And that paper, was written, I think, in 1950 or published in 1950. And the earliest paper on neural networks really was published in the 1940s. AI really got going in the 50s through the 70s. There was a lot of great work has been done all through that period of a variety of techniques. Neural networks got restarted again in the 1980s.
Can you define or tell us what neural networks are? I mean, I hear
sure. So I guess I want to say a couple of things about AI generally, which is that, first of all, there are, as I said, a lot of different kinds of techniques that go into any given program that you look at and that you're interacting with. There's usually more than one method being used to solve the problem, right? And or different aspects of the problem will have different kinds of methods that are appropriate to them. So there are symbolic techniques that involve kind of abstract reasoning or logical reasoning. There are statistical techniques. Broadly speaking, there are going to be those two classes of techniques, either logical techniques or statistical techniques to actually model the world and to model kind of intelligent behavior. And as I said, any given system that you look at is generally going to be mixing these up in a variety of ways. So, and I'll give an example of that in a second. machine learning itself tends to fall into two broad classes. One is called supervised learning, and supervised learning means that there's a teacher, quote unquote, which might just be experience. It's some kind of a feedback that tells you, was this a good answer or not a good answer?
Right.
Okay. So roughly speaking, the machine makes a guess like, is this a member of the category? It says yes, and it turns out to be wrong. And that, and because it's labeled as being in a different category, and the machine will go like, oh, I made a mistake, and it will adjust its representation of the category appropriately to not make that mistake again in the future. Now, the issue with supervised learning is that you need training data that are labeled. In other words, where you can say, this is an orchid, this is a house cat, this is a, that's a microphone, you know, things like that. So you have to actually label the data, and it can be very expensive to get labeled data because the labels typically come from human beings, actually. The human beings are the people who know this stuff anyway and can label it. So, but that's a very important kind of learning for sure. The other kind of learning is called, strangely enough, unsupervised learning, when there is no teacher like that. And that would be, for example, clustering algorithms. So when you start to say, like, this thing looks a lot like this, like I have a bunch of data and the data seem to fall into clusters and I want to find those, identify those clusters. And that doesn't need labels. It's just you, roughly speaking, you're looking for things that are close to each other and far away from everything else. That's mm-hmm. kind of the definition of a cluster.
Mm-hmm.
And that's easier because although you need a lot of data still, you don't have to have a human being labeling the data or some kind of experience model labeling the data and telling you whether it was the right answer or not the right mm-hmm. answer. So I'll take a pause there and say there's a lot of different kinds of machine learning algorithms and a lot of different kinds of AI mechanisms. Neural networks are a particular kind, and they're basically a model that says we're going to start with a very simple component, which we'll call a neuron after the neurons in our brains. They're not really neurons, but they kind of modeling certain aspects of neurons.
Right.
And the neurons are going to be connected to each other, and they will impact the computation of the neck of another neuron. So the idea is a neuron will sit here, and it will have a lot of input wires coming to it from neurons. Below it, let's say, okay, and each of those neurons below it is actually representing a feature of the situation that you're in. So, for example, if you were doing computer vision, each of those little neurons literally might be a pixel in the camera that took the picture. And let's say we're talking about black and white, each of those neurons will get an input value between 0, which is totally black, and 1, which is totally white, and then there'll be gray in between. Let's say mm-hmm. we're doing black and white.
Mm-hmm.
And so now we're going to put another neuron on top of that that's going to collect data from a bunch of neurons in the underlying retina, let's say. This thing looks like it's going to gather data from a region, and it's going to say, you know, everything on this side of the region is kind of dark, and everything on this side of some line is white. So maybe there's a boundary here, for example. That's the kind of thing it would be computing. So you have these things wired up, and the way it does that is that these wires have weights on them, okay? So that the wires, the connections between the neurons can be can allow information to pass or not allow information to pass depending on the weight. And that tells you, roughly speaking, the kind of neuron that it's feeding into is deciding how important is the data from this lower level neuron to the decision I'm going to make. And you just mm-hmm. keep cascading. And so that's how they operate once they've learned. Now the question becomes, how do you set the weights on those connections? And that's where that yeah, go.
Can I just ask quickly?
Sure, of course.
So is it the case, because all that sounds simple, but is it the case that you discover that even the simplest human event turns out to be incredibly complex in terms of how many sortings of importance you have to go through to understand something
you raise a big question, which is, so first of all, these algorithms do tend to be of kind of fixed length, and you're raising the point that sometimes we don't know how long we're going to have to compute before we get an answer. So these are typically very parallel kinds of algorithms. They're not sequential, and so they can't do everything, and you're pointing to some of the limitations. You know, is the principle simple? The answer is yes. But the reality is that the machines that are built out of these simple mechanisms are absolutely gigantic. I mean, they're huge. Mm-hmm. So I didn't mention how do you learn the weights on these links between the neurons.
Yeah.
And that's really the kind of where the learning component of neural networks comes in. And the way that works is that, you know, the machine will end up making a prediction at the very end. It'll say, like, I think this is David. I'm looking at this thing and I think it's David. And then, you know, the feedback will come back. No, that's actually not David. You know, that's actually a triangle or something like that, you know. And the machine will go, yeah, you know, I made a mistake. That wasn't David. This output layer where I said this was David, it was not weighting its inputs properly. So I better change the weights on those inputs so that I don't say that this was David. Okay.
Right.
And each of those layers says, well, I made a mistake too. I have to propagate my error backwards. And so that's the way these systems work, is they propagate error backwards during learning. And then when they're functioning, they kind of move forward through the weights that got computed via that error propagation.
But,
okay.
But can I just say that the element of supervision, right, is only at that end over there.
Boy, it's that's a really, no kidding. You know, it can take a long time to actually learn with a mechanism like this. And you know, then what raises the question, how much is it like human learning, and in what circumstances is it like human learning? I mean, because, you know, there are some things that we learn very slowly, you know,
yes,
maybe exactly how to, you know, exactly how to hit the golf ball, or, you know, take a lot of practice, you know, mm-hmm, or, but there's some things that we can learn, you know, all at once, right away, and we learn it and we never forget it. And,
right,
and right, you know, that's a very different kind of model of learning. So again, I'm just, you know, you're raising the point that as amazing as these machines are, and as amazing as what AI can do now is, there's a lot of things that we still don't understand about what's going to be involved in building. You know,
one of the things that I read about ChatGPT versus, or what's Microsoft, was Tay, the one that was
tweeted, yeah, yeah, the one was, that got withdrawn,
was that it, yeah, was that GPT had much more human feedback in the
it
training,
did, yes, mm-hmm,
and that Tay actually, I don't know if it had no human feedback or if it relied much more on the data that it was pointed at. So suddenly, you know, if you apply it to Twitter, which is a, you know, a hotbed of, it's a cesspool of ideas. Yeah. Well, went right away to, you know, we hate, yeah, Jews, and, you know,
yeah, because, yeah, 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 of course.
Because, right, there's a lot of, whereas something like, something with a human being, depending upon who that human being is, correcting it would say, no, we don't do that.
You know, I remember early on in the era when the internet was really first getting going and search engines were just getting going, we had in fact, Google had just been invented. It was still a Stanford University project. And, you know, what we think we can do is use the internet as a measure of truth. Like, we can just do a search for something, and if and count up the answers, and if more of them are on this side, then that's probably the right answer. And we were like, yeah, I don't think that's going to be true. And we actually typed in the Earth is flat. And you got, actually, at that time, more hits for the Earth is flat than for the Earth is round. And there's a reason for that, which is that people who believe the Earth is flat insist on asserting it all the time, whereas people who believe the Earth is round don't think they need to be claiming the Earth is round. They're not fighting against science and society to make this assertion, right?
No.
So I wouldn't do what I do. I mean, if I thought the data spoke for it themselves, I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing. I mean, I think that the data need interpretation. Now, I want to say something about this, by the way. I still haven't talked about how neural networks get applied to, or deep learning gets applied to, language. And I'll just say that very quickly.
Yeah, please.
All that these large language models, that they're called LLMs or neural language models, do, they have one task, which is to predict the next word. So what you do is you basically say, I need some milk. I'm going to go to the, what are you going to say?
Not cow. I'm going to go to the store.
I'm going to go to the store. Exactly. Yeah. Right. Okay. So it's an obvious prediction. And so what we want is for the machine to be able to make that prediction, given that, yeah, context, predict, yeah, the word store, or maybe the phrase grocery store or something like that.
Okay? Right.
Or maybe the name of a particular grocery store. So that's what you're going to predict. Right. It's gathering statistics about the frequency with which certain words follow other sequences of words, okay? And that's what these systems are doing. Mm-hmm. They're, you take a neural network and you put it in a paradigm where it's going to take the n preceding words and proceed, and then be able to predict the next word, okay? Or actually what it does is compute a probability distribution over all the words of the likelihood that that word is going to show up, okay? And then when you take a thing like ChatGPT or any neural language model, when it's going to be used for the generation mode, that's why it's called a language model. It's a model of the statistical likelihood of words following other words in the language, okay? Now, you might say to yourself, gee, there seems to be a lot more going on in language than just predicting the next word, and you'd probably be right. But it turns out that you can do a heck of a lot with this if you have a big enough memory and enough things. Mm-hmm. For one thing, it can memorize a lot of things, which is either good or bad. I mean, so for example, if you take these things and put in a passage from an incredibly common text like the King James Bible, you know, it'll actually reproduce verbatim a lot of the next sentence or something like that, just because it's seen that so many times, mm-hmm. right? And So that's what it's doing. It's predicting the next word. And if you interact with ChatGPT, you'll set it up and it'll predict the next. It'll kind of do that. Now, this is very expensive to compute. These models take millions and millions and millions of dollars of computing time to be able to get that. There aren't very many organizations that have that much data. In other words, these are all texts that people put online for their own reasons, mm-hmm. and to communicate with other people, and yet now we have this incredible data store of stuff that we can use to actually train a computer. So that's it's very expensive to compute these things, but it doesn't require any labeling. And the reason it doesn't require any labeling is because, and I'll tell you why, because
what do you mean by labeling?
You don't need a human being to say, tell me whether this was the correct next word or not, because a human being already has told you that in the millions and millions and millions of sentences that you've seen,
that you've just
where the word store followed a sentence that looked like that. Does that make sense? And so,
yes, totally.
And so that's kind of baked in already. That's what makes it feasible. So the thing is that you're right, that when you get a language model doing that, its output won't necessarily be quite what you had in mind. And so what OpenAI did, which was kind of the next step, was to take the output from a language model like that. Technical substrate was really at Google. A bunch of people did some advances, and then OpenAI picked that up and did that. I'm sure they're doing a lot of other things too, to be clear. I mean, I'm not trying to denigrate them. It's a lot of really smart people there. Yeah. But what they added, which was, you know, pretty smart, was to say, look, you know, the thing, we want to actually have some feedback to tell it this was a good answer or not a good answer, or good continuation or not a good continuation. And so they did pay the money to get people to provide that feedback. And interestingly enough, what they did is they used that training to train a computer, another computer program, to provide that feedback automatically so that they could amplify, because as much money as they paid to get people to answer these questions or make these evaluations, it still wasn't enough data. So they used that to train a computer that would then provide that feedback, which can be a little bit dangerous, but it worked in this case. I mean, it was worked very well. But yeah, that's what OpenAI did. The results, I have to say, have been pretty amazing. Like, the thing does not always work, and it often says foolish things, and it says crazy things, and it says incorrect things. But the fact that it can say anything at all is kind of
right.
staggering.
But it says things that everybody understands.
Yeah, you know,
enough to know that it's foolish or otherwise.
Yeah. You know, I think, you know, I will say this, that the people, I'm sure that there are people who worked on this who were sure it was going to work, but most of the people I've talked to work directly in this space were pretty surprised themselves that it worked as well as it did. I don't think they expected it to work as well as it does. So, and it's a mystery, frankly, why it does. I mean, the one thing to say about this also is these are really big big systems. And even though the individual components are very simple, the behavior comes from an interaction of a huge number of these things. And it's fair to say that we do not exactly understand why it works, which is a little bit scary sometimes. In other words, right?
Maybe we're there, but that's actually what I wanted to ask you is, like, you know, so we should be celebrating. And on the other hand, we should be a little bit, we should wake up in the middle of the night. So how should people who have no idea what you're talking about feel about
I don't know how
investing.
I feel about it, David. So you're asking.
There we go. Last question.
Look, what do I think? I think it's a great triumph. And I think, it is not the end of the line for AI. There's a lot of stuff that, again, we don't understand. So these machines, for example, there are certain fundamental things that they don't have, these kind of LLMs. They don't really have goals. When they're saying something to you, it's not because they want you to know something. You know? I mean, they don't seem to go through the process that we go through in producing intentional or goal-directed behavior, right? People give them the goal, so to speak, through these prompts, right? Through these original setups. But they don't do that themselves. You know, am I worried? No, I think it's a pretty amazing technology. I mean, I would love to talk more about the technology and its limitations, but we can jump to some of the social implications.
What are some of the implications of the technology? I'm not sure I understand.
Well, I think, first of all, even narrative science and our technology works in a very different fashion than this for the most part. People could look at that and get, worried that it's going to replace certain kinds of jobs. And the only thing I can say is that automation in general replaces certain kinds of jobs, and it has for the last 150 years,
Absolutely.
Long before even computers.
Yeah, not a lot of work for horses these days.
Yeah, exactly. And in fact, the horse population of the United States peaked around, you can actually see peak horse, it's called, when were the most horses in the U.S. and then the decline in the horse population because they weren't.
Because they didn't have any jobs for them.
Yeah, right, exactly. So so I don't think that's going to, first of all, that's not going to happen to human beings because I don't think our purpose in this world is to have a job necessarily. So, I mean, without getting into too much detail, people are not animals and they deserve us. Well, people are animals. I mean, human beings are animals, but we're a certain kind of animal with a certain kind of rights by virtue of the kind of animal. I think this is a great triumph for technology. And I think computer technology generally has been just an amazing thing. Now, a lot of stuff has been being automated. I mean, even before, and we can decide whether we would have called it AI or not. I mean, do you think of a travel planning site as AI? Well, it kind of is. I mean, a lot of the work that went into that would be things like, again, route planning or scheduling. Again, those were AI problems 20 or 30 years ago or 40 years ago, and then they got solved, and we don't think of them as AI anymore.
Well, I mean, some of the stuff that so many people rely on, embrace every day. You pull up a song and the computer suggests to you a bunch of different songs. And damn it, if it's not right about all sorts of things.
Yeah, and absolutely.
Like,
right.
And you either run from that, or you celebrate. It's like, God, I never even heard of this artist. Fabulous. So cool.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's really, for example, I guess what I'm trying to say is did certain classes of work go away? Yes. I mean, there aren't there aren't as many secretaries in the world as there used to be.
Right.
Because of word processing instead of typewriters.
Right.
There aren't or computers instead of filing systems. Okay. There aren't as many travel agents in the world as there used to be. Okay.
Right.
I don't think but first of all, I mean, people are finding other work and there are still travel agents. They do very high end travel, and there are still executive secretaries and they do all kinds of much more complicated kinds of work. And in general, I think the elimination of certain classes of jobs isn't necessarily, a bad thing, especially, if it increases the wealth of the society overall. Now, there is a question of how are we going to organize society? If this is true, then what's happening is that we're going to be able to basically produce more and more with fewer and fewer people, the question becomes then how to distribute the fruits of this.
Sure.
Because the way it's distributed right now is everybody has a job and they make their money. Their livelihood comes from the work that they do. And if their work is less important, nevertheless, it's almost tautological. There's no point in producing all this stuff if nobody can buy it. What I'm saying? I think that those are real issues. And I think, but I'm confident that we're going to figure out a way to make it happen because, again, there's no point in doing this if it doesn't improve human life. I mean, what's the point, actually?
Right.
I mean, so I think that I mean, I'm talking about from an economic aspect. I mean, there are scientific and technical challenges that are exciting to people who like that kind of challenge, but most people are not that interested in how it's getting done. They're just interested in what it means, you know, for them. So hopefully it'll end up meaning something positive for them. You know, I think.
Are there places where, you know, there, it is frequently the case in all sorts of disciplines that, that what's happening at the edges of those disciplines is probably the most interesting stuff. So is there stuff that's going on that's, you know, what are the, now that they've quote solved this, what are they trying to solve now that,
Yeah. So the first thing to say is that we've made a tremendous amount of progress. We haven't really solved any of the problems that we touched on at the beginning about context and whatever. We've managed those problems, I would say, in a way that developed yields useful technology. Because, you know, you asked the question, you know, should we be afraid of this? You know, right now, these machines are doing some pretty amazing things. It's a very exciting time to be an AI person, you know what I mean? Because a lot of stuff that we've been working on for so long, things are finally beginning to work, you know, and that's a pretty exciting time. But, you know, it's clear that specifically neural networks don't understand the world the way that human beings understand the world. They don't see the world the way you and I see the world, okay? And that can be seen very clearly in the kinds of mistakes that they make, which are inhuman mistakes. Okay, they make mistakes. So let me give you an example. I mean, there's some pretty, you can find this on the internet. There's some pretty famous examples that are pretty obvious. For example, you can construct images where you and I will look at the image and what we see is static. You know, we see like snow on a color television set in the old days, you know, just a bunch of random colored pixels. Okay. And the machine will say, oh, that's a robin. It'll look at that set of pixels, which is hash, it's noise as far as we can tell, and it'll say, oh, that's a robin. Okay. So it sees something that's not there. Okay. The flip side of that is you can take a stop sign and alter it by changing some pixels or putting some stickers on it, and the machine will say, oh, it says speed limit 45. Okay. No human being would make those mistakes. No human being would look at the hash and say it's a robin. No human being would look at the stop sign with a few pixels changed and say, oh, it says speed limit 45. All right. So it's a category of error that we don't make, and it shows that the machines don't see the world the way that we see the world. Now, the flip side of that is that the machines, we make mistakes that the machines don't make. Okay. Like we do a lot of things in decision making, for example, based on the most recent information. That's a common preference that people have, is to overweight recent information.
Yes.
Right. You know, and for certain kinds of decisions, of course, that's the right thing to do. And probably, to be clear, in the environment in which we human beings evolved, it most likely was the right thing to do. But in the world that we live in now, it's not always the right thing to do. Absolutely. And so we tend to make these kinds of decision-making errors that machines will not make, okay? And so to me, this opens up a super exciting possibility, which is of collaborative human and artificial intelligence. And not just to me, I should say, this is a theme that a lot of people are now working on, because it's an exciting idea, the idea that people have strengths that the machines don't have, the machines have strengths that we don't have, you know, they make mistakes that we don't make, we make mistakes that they don't make. Maybe working together, we can actually do something that neither the human being nor the machine by itself could do.
I want to know, what is it about that picture, right, that the computer sees as a robin?
Right.
Because maybe there's something there.
Yeah. So that's actually especially in light of the rise of neural networks, which are these huge models, as I said, and not necessarily very well understood.
Yeah.
You know, that's raised, that does raise a lot of concerns that people have, which is, why should I take a decision based on something the machine said if I don't understand why it said it? You know what I mean? Or why that's a good recommendation. And so this has given rise to a whole kind of thrust in AI called explainable AI, which is that the machine should be able to somehow explain its reasoning to you so that you can at least get some sense of whether this is actually correct or sensible, or ways in which it's not correct or not sensible. And that's a huge area of research right now. Absolutely.
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting. That's super interesting.
Yeah.
So So are there things that keep you up all night that have to do with this?
No, I mean, I'm not worried about computers taking over the world. I don't think that they have the same, I mean, right now they don't have that kind of goal structure. You know, I don't think that they, I guess people are worried about the idea that they might take a goal and kind of do something obsessive with it that turns out to be detrimental to human beings.
Yes, that's what the movies are about, right?
Was the theme of 2001 of Kubrick's 2001.
Hal.
Absolutely,
yeah.
The machine wasn't exactly malevolent. It's just it was confused in some sense, yeah. Right? I mean, right. And you know, and so it therefore made a bunch of mistakes, which included killing people, right? So I mean, right. I'm not that worried about that, actually. I don't worry about Terminator kinds of scenarios very
right.
much. I don't worry about that much. You know, people are to some extent creatures of habit, and they, you know, there are things that we're comfortable with, and as those things start to change, okay, but if they change very quickly, things are changing
exactly.
very quickly, and it's easy to get confused. There are a couple of things coming up on the horizon that I think are going to change things very dramatically, and I the only thing I can say is I try not to worry about them because I don't think there's anything to be done. You know what I mean? These things are going to happen, and I apologize if this is annoying to people or upsetting to any of the listeners, but let's take the genetic engineering of human beings.
Mm-hmm.
You know, is it a good idea to genetically engineer human beings? I don't know. Is it going to happen? Of course it's going to happen. I mean, I don't care if you pass laws against it or don't pass laws against it. There are going to be countries that are going to do it, or there are going to be people who will decide to break that law. And some of it, initially, of course, it will be very benign. This child would be born with a genetic disease that we can now prevent by genetically engineering them. They'll be exactly as they would have been, but they won't have
some
horrible
have this
disease.
Thing.
And why would you not do that? Of course you will do that.
Absolutely.
You know? And the next thing will be like, well, I don't know, you know, we could make her smarter. You know, we could make her taller. We could make him faster. You know what I mean? And we could make them live longer. And so all of that stuff is going to happen. I don't see a way to prevent it, you know? So first of all, the genetic engineering of human beings, I mean, I'm not trying to change the subject from AI.
There's a series of things
coming up which are going to happen that are really going to change society quite dramatically, maybe even more dramatically than it's already been changed. Genetic engineering of human beings is one of them. Life extension technology. So right now, we are living longer and longer. I mean, thank God you and I are pretty healthy and vigorous still, you know, I mean, you know, as they say.
Yeah.
Historically people didn't live that long and weren't that vigorous as long as we are now. And that's due to modern nutrition and modern medicine. And there's a lot
hygiene
of things,
in
you know,
general.
So,
yeah.
You know, my dad died last year. He was 100 years old, you know, and I think that's becoming more and more common. I think nowadays, if we have someone who we know and love who dies at 60 or 65, we go, well, that's young.
Yeah.
You know, even if they die at 75, we might go, well, that's pretty young, you know, and we feel a little sad about that, you know. So there will be life extension technology that's going to be developed, a variety of kinds, and we will live longer and longer. And the third thing was artificial intelligence, you know, and the capabilities of machine. And the fourth thing is going to be direct brain machine connections, which people are working on.
Have been working on for quite a while. And
that's exactly right. So are we there yet? The answer is no.
No.
But we're making progress on all four of these things, and they will get better and better, you know. And if you ask me, should they be done? I can't answer that question. Will they be done? Yes, they will be done. You know, I mean, it's almost the case that anything that can be done is going to be done at some level. You know, I mean, should we have built the nuclear bomb? I don't know, but it could be built. Therefore, it was built, you know, and so these things are going to happen. And they're really going to change very fundamentally, I think, about what it's going to mean to be a human being. That the injunction is on us as human beings to practice our to build our technology in a manner that's ethical.
Larry Birnbaum, thank you so much for being
David, thanks for the opportunity. This was a hell of a lot of fun. I really appreciate
this. Really fun.
Yeah,
me too. Me too. I really am. Really am grateful.
You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.